What China is effectively doing is promising to do just a very few of the many things it already promised to do repeatedly.
China's president promises a more open economy. It's Wednesday, April 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a new study details malnourishment among Rohingya. Asian American women seek equal pay. VOA business scene. Blue light to calm nerves. And a virtual treadmill. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Speaking at the opening ceremony of the Boao Forum for Asia annual conference in Hainan Province Tuesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping renewed a pledge to open up the country's economy, lower import tariffs, and widen market access for foreign investors. Mr. Xi called the Cold War mentality and zero-sum games old-fashioned and outdated. Isolation, he said, will only hit walls. Peaceful development and cooperation, he added, result in win-win and multi-win. The comments, marking the 40th anniversary of China's economic opening under Deng Xiaoping, came amid trade tensions with the world's other big economy, the United States, over their trade imbalance and the handling of American intellectual property. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the timing was intentional. But the pledges made in the speech are too little and too late.
What China is effectively doing is promising to do just a very few of the many things it already promised to do repeatedly. When it was let into the World Trade Organization, it was supposed to not do any of the things it's currently doing. And now it's just promising to this very token opening, really as a way just to tempt the United States. It's not going to work with the Trump administration, but it may work with some particular businesses, which are always sort of enthralled to the idea of selling something to every person in China.
Will it send stocks higher?
Oh, of course. That's simply because it suggests that there's going to be sort of an easing in the tension, or that somehow it's going to work things out and go back to the status quo.
President Trump has continued to sound upbeat, looking at his relationship with his Chinese counterpart, and that this matter of the trade tensions will be worked out.
I think that's a sort of a tactical approach, but I think it's also Mr. Trump's style. And Mr. Trump, he generally, if somebody's going to do something he likes, then he's going to like them. I don't think he feels the need to demonize people, but rather to let the behind-the-scenes negotiations, the pressures that come of this sort of a nation-to-nation sort of fight, let those work themselves out. And in the meantime, he's willing to say, yeah, I love the guy, and we got a great relationship. So he can kind of present two faces at once, and it is something we haven't seen in a president for a long time. I think in some ways it's a good thing, and it certainly has, I think, caused the Chinese to worry a bit just from the sheer unpredictability of Mr. Trump. And they know he's on to something by pointing out that they really haven't done any of the things they promised when they were let into WTO, and that goes back many years now. And it's finally the U.S. president has actually called them on it. So I think it's got China worried a bit.
Mr. Xi's remarks come as China has approached the Pacific island of Vanuatu about establishing a permanent military presence there. What do you make of it?
This is something we've seen before. And President Xi promised the U.S. president that they would not militarize the man-made islands in the South China Sea, and they went ahead and did it. In the case of Djibouti, China insisted it was not going to build a military base there or even wanted a military base, and now it's got a military base and is on the verge of taking over management of the entire port. This is coming in Vanuatu, and it's really just the logical outcome of Chinese activity in the South Pacific over the last decade plus, which has very successfully and insinuated itself into these island nations, usually with money being the immediate tool. And they've done a very good job, and this base is coming unless something is done to stop it.
Vanuatu's foreign minister on Tuesday denied the original report by Australia's Fairfax Media. He insisted no one in the government has ever talked about a Chinese military base in Vanuatu near Australia. He said Vanuatu is a non-aligned nation. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. China's Xi Jinping pledges to cut auto tariffs, press ahead with reforms. Heavy Facebook use exposed Southeast Asia to breaches of personal data. Philippine High Court hears arguments to remove Duterte enemy Sereno. Fiji braces for second cyclone in just over a week. Pakistan launches countrywide polio eradication drive. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A study by the U.S. Center for Disease Control says malnutrition and anemia far exceed internationally established emergency levels among ethnic minority Rohingya children who have fled to refugee camps in Bangladesh. The study shows a total of 269 children aged between 6 months and 5 years were examined in the Kutupalong refugee camp in October of last year. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked with one of the researchers. Blanche Green Kramer is an epidemiologist with the CDC's Emergency Response and Recovery Branch.
We found this really high prevalence of acute malnutrition and anemia among these children, and they exceeded those emergency thresholds that were established by the World Health Organization. And this highlights the importance of the ongoing efforts that exist there to ensure access to adequate treatment and also preventative service across all refugees that are in the camps at the moment. One of the findings from the study was led to the recommendation of increasing the diversity of the diet and advocating for a more diversified family ration. The Rohingya are primarily dependent on food distributed by the humanitarian community, so it's essential that these distributions be more diversified. Initially, they were fairly limited. They contain not too many micronutrients, but they've been revised since the findings to include more fortified foods.
So some of the recommendations, though, have already been enacted. Is that correct?
Yes. The study was done in October of last year. And while this publication is just being shared now, efforts were made immediately to enact programmatic responses based on what we found.
Give us an example of what the normal or average diet of one of these refugees might have been when the study started and what it is now.
The initial distributions early on contained very few micronutrients. Very early on, it was just rice. I don't have information at the moment on what exactly is contained in the new rations, but I know that they've diversified beyond just rice to include other foods that would help with the micronutrient malnutrition. You know, back in August, when the first influx came, there were around 700,000 Rohingya that had fled and joined an estimated 200,000 who had fled in earlier waves since the 1990s. There are now 883,900. So the numbers have continued to increase. That was as of March 24th. So this is an ongoing emergency. And one of the concerns is that monsoon season is coming up soon, and it threatens to worsen the current humanitarian situation. So there's a need for ongoing response and ongoing evaluations to make sure that the response meets the needs of the population.
This study was carried out in one refugee camp, while there are many. Why was one chosen?
This was the start of what was a three-survey study. So this was the first one that was completed, and recommendations were made immediately based on this. There were three different sites, the Kutupalong refugee camp, the Nayapara refugee camp, and then all of the makeshift and spontaneous sites were captured in a third survey to try and get at all the different situations. But this was the first that was done.
Who is this information being shared with?
We work as technical partners. We support the humanitarian agencies that are on the ground, and so we work in collaboration with them. And this study was done as part of a collaborative with the nutrition cluster, the nutrition sector in Bangladesh. And so our imperative was to collect this information and immediately share it with those partners so they had data. This was the first nutrition data that came out of this emergency, and so it was important to get that information to partners immediately to make the programmatic recommendation so that things could be done as soon as possible.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Blanche Green Kramer, an epidemiologist with the CDC's Emergency Response and Recovery Branch. Nearly 700,000 Rohingya have fled from Myanmar to Bangladesh to escape a military crackdown since last August. Happening now in Asia, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has asked it to rule on whether it has jurisdiction over the deportations of Rohingya people from Myanmar to Bangladesh, a possible crime against humanity. A ruling affirming jurisdiction could pave the way for a prosecutor to investigate. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening. Equal Pay Day is the symbolic day observed in the United States in mid-April to raise awareness of the gender pay gap. Vimala Pongsavan is the proud daughter of Laotian refugees. She was born, raised, and educated in the northeastern U.S. state of Rhode Island. She is also the public policy director for the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum and spoke with VOA Asia Facebook Live just a short time ago about the pay gap between men and women, the challenges various ethnicities of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders face in closing the pay gap.
I'm from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. It's a city of 45,000 people in the smallest state, the greatest state, we like to say, have spent my whole life there before making the move to Naphof in D.C. My family's originally from Laos, so my parents and my older sister came to Rhode Island as refugees from Laos in 1981.
Did this background influence your decisions to join this organization?
I've always been deeply, interested in how I can change policy and change the world. You know, we grew up, we were like, we want to change the world. Mm-hmm. And ever since I graduated college, I did a year of AmeriCorps Vista in Chinatown, Boston. And that was where I really learned about community organizing, learned about how Asian communities came together and built power. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that's one of the major reasons is because of my family and, the way I was raised and just growing up as a daughter of refugees.
Tell us a little bit about your organization, what mm-hmm. you all do.
Our mission is to build power for AAPI women and girls in the United States. And we do that as the only national AAPI organization working on behalf of women and girls with a reproductive justice framework. And so we work in the intersections of economic justice, of immigration reform, and reproductive health and reproductive rights.
Women right now, on average, make about 80 cents mm-hmm. to the male dollar. Mm-hmm. Does that apply also to AAPI communities?
Well, depends what which AAPI group you're talking about, right? Okay. And so on the average, AAPI women make 87 cents for every dollar a white man makes. But what's really important is realizing that our community is big. We're very different. We have over 50 different ethnicities. We speak over 100 different languages as a community. And we also came here under very different circumstances. Mm-hmm. So from like families like mine who came as refugees, there are families who came through, other family, immigration pathways. There are families who've been here for hundreds and hundreds of years as mm-hmm. well. And so our experiences are very different, and it's really important that we're able to tell the different stories of the different types of folks in our communities.
And what else do you think needs to happen in this country to close the pay gap?
One big thing, especially for the Asian American community, is getting better data on our communities. Mm-hmm. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we're big, different and very diverse community, but our data puts us in the aggregate, and that doesn't tell the full story about what the needs of different communities are. And you see just a big, vast difference between like Chinese Americans and like Cambodian Americans. And so, what we need is to really disaggregate the data so that we know exactly what each group needs, and then so that we can get the resources that they need.
Vimala Ponksivan, Public Policy Director for the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. You can see the entire interview with our Skylar Ogden on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Coming up, the visit is over at a Philippines resort. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, the Philippine Supreme Court began hearing arguments on a government bid to invalidate the appointment of the court's top judge, whom President Rodrigo Duterte calls an enemy who needs to be removed. The embattled judge is the Philippines' first woman chief justice and is facing challenges on several fronts. We provide both sides of the day's stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a popular Philippines resort area is shut down, and Japan helps Cambodia on today's VOA's Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
President Rodrigo Duterte announced plans to shut down the popular tourist destination of Boracay Island in the Philippines for a six-month period. He says the island has too much environmental damage and called it a cesspool. Boracay accounts for approximately 20% of the country's tourism revenue, and many residents rely on tourism for their livelihoods. Harry McCullough is a tourist from Northern Ireland.
So I've heard about the closing of the island. I think it's bad. I understand why they want to do it, but I feel bad for the people that live here and require the tourism to survive. And I don't know what they're going to do when there are no tourists coming. I don't know how everyone's going to survive with no money coming into the island. And I think it's quite sad.
Hundreds of Boracay hotels, restaurants, tour operators, and business establishments have been renegotiating or closing down deals on bookings for rooms, flights, weddings, and other events and facilities. Local residents who rely on that money say the shutdown is too harsh and that not enough details have been provided about the transition. In response, the government has said that the current infrastructure is simply unsustainable and that it plans to provide an emergency fund to help the island's workers. Many Boracay businesses were found to be discharging untreated wastewater directly into the sea, and much of the influx of tourism that began in the mid-80s also came with unregulated development. Isa Peters is a tourist from Belgium.
We came here to Boracay because of windsurfing and the kiting. If not, we wouldn't be here because it's too crowded, too many people, too many buildings. That's the real paradise for us.
The Philippine government is currently planning to place police and or military checkpoints at ports to keep tourists away from the island. Boracay Island will be officially closed starting on April 26. Japan signed a $4.6 million grant and an $86 million loan with Cambodia this week. The country's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Taro Kono, said Japan wanted to help Cambodia become an upper-middle-income country by 2030. The deal was signed amidst criticism from the international community, many of whom say Prime Minister Hun Sen's crackdown on government critics should not be rewarded. The Cambodian government dissolved the main opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party in November, prompting some countries to cut aid. And former opposition leader Sam Rainsy is calling for a boycott of the general election on July 29th. Despite the protests, the grant and loan agreement of $90 million was signed on Sunday in the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh and will be used for economic and electricity transmission projects in the capital. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, Fiji is dealing with a second potentially destructive cyclone to hit the Pacific Island nation in just over a week. Authorities advised residents to prepare survival kits and be ready for evacuation as Cyclone Kenny approached and was upgraded to a Category 3 storm. You'll find this and other great stories and features on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Spanish researchers have developed a technique to quickly remedy acute psychosocial stress, described as a short-term intense stress that occurs during social or interpersonal relationships caused by a verbal argument. VOA's Mariama Diallo tells us the treatment involves blue light-emitting diodes.
Researchers say it can typically take people who suffer from acute psychosocial stress more than half an hour to recover from an episode. But they found when patients are exposed to blue ambient light, the relaxation process happens more quickly.
Paramos la luz ambiente azul.
We compare the relaxation of the blue light with that of the white ambient light and find that reaching the minimum stress point is 3 times faster with the blue light.
After completing the stress test, a dozen volunteers were exposed to the blue light while they sat in beanbag chairs. An EEG cap was attached to their heads to record the data. This finding could make a difference in kids with behavioral issues in classrooms.
When children here have an aggressive outbreak, it can take half hour until they relax, but with the blue light, they were much better within a minute or so. We showed that they really do not have to be out of class for long.
The technique can also be used outside the classroom.
For instance, someone gets to work on Monday morning and is stressed after a traffic jam. They could enter a room like this and for 3 minutes be exposed to the blue light. It could also help them relax the same way when they return home.
Therefore, greatly improving people's quality of life.
We believe that this opens the door in the therapeutic field for intervention with the population that has mental health problems, and also with the rest of the population, so that everyone can have a moment of relaxation.
The research was published in the PLOS ONE Journal, a peer-reviewed open-access scientific journal published by the nonprofit Public Library of Science. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Virtual reality, or VR, is finding more applications as the technology matures. It's no longer only being used for gaming or entertainment. One Austin-based company is using VR to improve health by making cardiovascular workouts more fun. VOA's Elizabeth Lee walks us through the real details.
This is more than just watching TV while exercising on a treadmill. It's a fully immersive experience that transports you to a world where you might find yourself racing against a virtual person.
You have much more motivation to actually get running and do something that pushes your limits. What's pretty cool. Whoa.
The company Blue Goji created the Infinity Treadmill with virtual reality in mind.
I like the music.
Using the technology to make exercise more engaging.
Not just for 20 minutes running in a boring treadmill. It's much more fun.
The belt keeps users from falling. In addition to encouraging better cardiovascular health, the active use of virtual reality also helps solve a common problem while wearing a VR headset, says Blue Goji's Kira Constum.
So a lot of VR experiences cause motion sickness because there's a disconnect in the brain, just psychologically. You're moving in the game, but you're not moving in real life. And we have come up with a solution. When you're moving on the treadmill and you're moving in the game, it mitigates that motion sickness, and you really get full immersion without all the negative side effects.
Any disorientation usually goes away quickly, but every user is different.
Pretty quickly you adjust to it. 10 seconds, but just.
I don't get motion sickness easily, but I got a little, felt a little queasy at one point when I was out of control, so it's surprisingly realistic.
The cost for the hardware and software is fairly steep at $12,000, but Constum says the virtual reality treadmill is ideal for high-end gyms, rehabilitation centers, and physical therapy clinics. The company plans to make the treadmill available to the public next year. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Austin.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on the radio throughout Asia if you happen to be traveling around. We're in the Philippines. TZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City. Thanks to everyone there who is listening today. And our thanks, as always, go to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, Ira Melman are part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a great day ahead.